All right, welcome. We're back from earlier today. This is like a part two, but we'll be on a familiar turf that if you missed our morning on this, you'll be all right. I don't have it up on the drive yet for folks who have had access, but it'll be up tonight. And we're following up. We're talking about Putin, the globalist. this idea. And it's a thing that we get into from time to time because it comes up and it comes up now in many ways. Like the obvious thing is that he's not a globalist because all the globalist institutions are the ones that are censoring you when you communicate about the subject in a way that supportive of Russia. So while one could argue that that's one big, smoke screen, and that they're all driving us towards communism. I have a question. If they're driving us towards communism, like if it's communism that they're driving us towards, like the World Economic Forum, why did they have the Soviets lose the Cold War? Like if everything's staged and arranged, why did they stage the collapse of communism? Why did they create the whole narrative that since they control the whole narrative, right? Since they control everything, why did they create the whole narrative that communism was bad if they want you if they want communism? It's because the word communism, it has a special meaning in America. It doesn't mean what it means anywhere else in the world, and that's cool. That's fine. I mean, America is an exceptional place. It kind of, I guess, it kind of deserves to make up its own words for things. But when you're trying to communicate clearly, some people would say that it's useful to distinguish communism from other types of totalitarianism, Some would say it's an important distinction to make. I understand in cases where maybe it's even splitting hairs, but in many ways it's not. So, well, we left off, we were talking about how the Russians got this dude named Surkov to kind of come up with how Russia is going to have a narrative and an approach, and how they can have it and it not be ideologically distinct. Meaning, how can they use the language of liberalism and modernity, like, in that very narrow kind of sense of the sort of Western modern concept of legitimate political set up, right? So after the collapse of the Soviet Union, that's what Russia established, right? So, and that's where we left off. We're actually explaining, because people seem very confused, why there are still so many interest groups in Russia, in these pillars of Russian society, talking about like the power pillars in Russian society, why so many of them are oriented towards the West. Well, what in the hell do you think the problem with communism was, insofar as being cut off from world markets, right? The idea was they were trying to become more representative, become more democratic, quote unquote, whatever that means, become more market oriented, become more westernized. And to end the Cold War and to integrate into the global economy. And their only real one condition is that they do so as a sovereign country. And that meant sovereignty over, number one, its territoriality, and sovereignty, number two, in the area of its where the money goes, you can say, the economy. And now they weren't really in the position to really start to establish an independent currency, which it used as something for trade until recent years, really with the development of, well, parallel to the development of BRICS. Russia does a lot of trade in rubles now. I mean, they have, this goes back to before this conflict. Russia's been introducing the ruble for some type of, it hadn't been really like a reserve currency, but they've been using it for transactions for some time. I think even Miller, when Miller was over at Gazprom, they were doing that. Forgive me if I'm wrong on that, but I think so. So this is a thing in process for a while. But and then we talked about how in the Western mind, in the Western imagination, Russia is a dictatorship, right? And then, so then when people who might be sympathetic to what Russia is doing, and then they think, well, they can solve it easily because the dictatorship, just Putin just has to sign some executive order and it's done. So then, what, you know, and then you have the other problem of people not understanding what, you know, intranational or international and transnational or supranational organizations really do. They don't really understand what they do, what they symbolize. Many of them are symbolic, and they kind of create fast track for networking opportunities. I mean, you get people all in one room, whether it's, like you wouldn't need countries to meet, right, for G7, for the countries that, you know, have nominated each other, the G, whatever that is, G7, to talk about, to you know, issue some kind of statements, you know, whatever that means, on the group of seven, on usually global economic matters. It's just not necessary, other than actually very similar to other international and supranational forums, as networking hubs where you can kind of sidebar. And most of what actually happens, all the business that really gets done is actually all the sidebar stuff. It's actually all the informal aspects of those types of meetings. And then, and because Russia was supposed to be on a trajectory, you see, it was supposed to be, you know, hey, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Remember all that? And then Russia was trying to integrate into these things. So it isn't like it's a dictatorship that it was trying to integrate, and then one day, as a dictatorship, it declares we're no longer trying to integrate. Like, doesn't even make sense. And there's multiple approaches to integration. There's integration through subordination, and then there's integration as co-equal partners. So the thing is that we talked about earlier, one of the goals in the full spectrum domination plan of the Russian, really the Russian Committee on the Survival of Russia, is really where the, you know, the Putin group comes out of. You have this whole catastrophe with Yeltsin and everything, right? So when you look at it through the lens of a plan that goes through stages of development, some of that then starts to make more sense. But I think more to the point is, with these institutions or these trade deals or this sort of orientation of consistently referring to the Western powers as our partners, you know, these are all aspects of diplomacy, basic cordiality, but also that Lavrov and Putin and these folks, they're actually responsible to a sovereigntist mission for Russia. And what the Western powers wanted, they wanted that orientation towards integration, but they wanted also Russia to be flexible about territorial integrity and flexible about you can call it denationalization, but that shouldn't be confused with like privatization versus socialization. It should be thought of in terms of whether you plug in capital leakage or capital outflows and you loop them back into the domestic economy. And you can only really do that, you know, in other words, you can have private enterprise and large scale private enterprise, but the owners, you know, have to be Russian. The money, right, the bank that the money goes into, the profits have to be a Russian bank. You see what I'm saying? You can't do like the limits on the sort of offshore stuff. And those were the big fights that were happening in the 90s. And of course, like the ultra liberals were like, oh no, you have to let the oligarchs do everything. Otherwise it's capital flight. And it's like, asshole, capital flight is the issue we're trying to tackle. How are you going to say that you're concerned that capital flight is going to occur from your, you know, your aims to end capital flight? I mean, yeah, there are ways to do that, sort of like printing money to end inflation. Of course, you can do things that encourage more capital flight, but you don't give up having a fucking country out of that concern. You got to do something, and that something is what started happening around the year 2000. And so when I look at responsible leadership, you know, it isn't, you know, it's we speak in terms of categories because we're trying to describe the world, okay? But categories don't exist in the world. They only exist in our descriptions. It's like a map, you know, a map is like color coded and stuff like that. But the color coding isn't physically on the fucking ground, right? Okay. So likewise, when we come up, when we talk about, well, this group are sovereigntists and these group are globalists and stuff like that, that's a much more kind of black and white description of a lot of more kind of dynamic and nuanced, complex, you know, tug of war, give and take, this and that, fence sitter, Johnny come lately, all kind of different motivations and different things going. It's really more of a shit show than anything else. So the way that you keep, I mean, just to understand, I mean, you know, Russia was kind of blown up when the Soviet Union collapsed, right? I mean, then, you know, so Ukraine spun off and all this stuff, right? So that's where you're starting from. Like, that's your starting point, okay? And then you have all of these, in other words, how are you going to avoid to become like Ukraine? You could basically kind of take Russia and Ukraine, and Ukraine at the starting point, at right at the moment of the collapse of the Soviet Union, was super wealthy in human resources, education levels, like talk about your number of doctors and, you know, engineers and stuff like that. You had this robust economy. You have all the steel and wheat, all these natural resources and development mills, industrial production. Okay. It's a microcosm of a lot of the things that Russia inherited, just on a slightly smaller scale, maybe about a quarter scale or something. And it really well positioned them for the future, okay? And the future was bright. In 1992 or 93, you know, anyone would say, hey, you know, homie, the world's your oyster. And had Russia been a globalist World Economic Forum colony or puppet state or whatever, you just would have seen the outcomes of Ukraine in Russia. And you were actually seeing that, you know, in the 90s. And we compare it, and it's not like all over Russia you don't have like fuckers shooting up crocodile and hookers and weird shit and whatever. I mean, that's, you know, it's a society, okay? But we talk about the levels of destitution and hopelessness and the numbers. So yeah, these things still exist, okay? Russia isn't like North Korea where, you know, it's like such a police state that you can't even like be a bum, right, on a corner somewhere. So yeah, Russia has homeless people. They have, right? It's like, it's a society. And these actually things should be a relief, you know? These, it's actually very strange because, you know, we talk about narrative jamming and narrative redirection. And in a sense, a lot of Russia and the way that it tried to make the best out of the post-Soviet collapse and its sort of Western ideological orientation. I mean, Western, of course, obviously Marxism is a Western philosophy, it's German, but you know what we're saying. A Western liberal capitalist framework. And so you can see that in order to do that, you can't, you know, even though maybe in a kind of a type of conservative mind, there's international business, and then you have these big socialist groups like the UN or the World Trade Organization or the International Monetary Fund, and these are somehow all the communists, and they're stopping, you know, this world trade or, you know, capitalism from happening or something like that. That's not at all what's going on. It's actually the capitalists, you know, are the ones that set up these institutions, you know, and a lot of them are protectionist and mercantilist and effectively just, you know, cartels and things like that. Businesses don't like competition, you know, actually that's like a golden rule. Like, you know, businesses are allergic to competition. I mean, they don't want, in terms of their own limited understanding of their self-interest, let's say, in that sense, the way that the market forces them to be, let's say, immediately responsible to shareholders and not really sort of like even the mid to long-term viability of the industry. So there's a lot of weird things about these market forces, but one thing that would be very hard to argue is that communism was bad for Russia and that Russia should, you know, integrate into, you know, more like the global economy and be a kind of Western democratic country like other developed countries, sort of like what in this sort of Western modernist concept was called normal, like be a normal country, right? And that was what Russia was supposed to do, in other words, right? And so those organizations, like the World Trade Organization and like all these things, that is the way that it's done, okay? That isn't like a second conspiracy separate from Russia, you know, now becoming a you know, capitalist, free, democratic country or whatever. You see how a lot of these confusions start? And they're kind of easy to nip in the bud, right? Like if the globalists wanted communism, well, then why did they stage the Cold War to go like that? Why not just further build the communism, you know? No, because it's not, it's something else. And even though it's heuristic kind of shorthand in American pop politics to call everything totalitarian communism, you know, it's like calling, I don't know, like, you know, in some countries, every 4x4 is called a Jeep. You know what I mean? In some countries, you could have like a Chevy Blazer, you could have whatever it is, Range Rover, whatever it is, it's called a Jeep. And in the United States, anything, whenever it's like corrupt or bad, or the government does things, it's called communism. I know, it just is what it is. I mean, I deal with it. I don't get into it that much. I know what people mean by it, and I'm not against the things that they're concerned about. And a lot of the things that they propose as solutions are things I agree with. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying these people are wrong or anything. I'm just saying, like, you know, if definitions of words have meanings, maybe we ought to use them sometimes. I mean, it gets difficult to constantly have to translate what, you know, what people are trying to say, you know, and what they think that they mean, you know. But that's what we do. We have to, because that's the people that we've been handed. That's the this is the moment that we're in. This is the society that we have and the language that we're using. So we have to use what we have and build from there. So when you look at Russia's moves, all of these were pretty consistent. And then they knew from the beginning that they didn't like Putin. I have in my possession a Time magazine from 2000 or 2001 or something. I think January 2001. They're like, it's now been 1 year. And it's a ridiculous article because so many, it's actually like one of those, it's a special edition. So there's like three articles on Putin's Russia. And suddenly in 2001, they like, you know, all the, you know how there's like old abandoned apartment buildings and or like, an apartment block that people have little cellars or little basements in the apartment blocks and they look like basements. So they did like photo shoots of people in basements. And, you know, I'm sorry, like a working class Russian guy, you know, in 2001, who's 50 years old, who's got his like 1981 mustache going on and he's a bit long in the tooth and, you know, weathered, wife beater a little bit, you know, stale. It's going to look kind of post-apocalyptic to you, I suppose, you know, but a lot of these are cultural things and things that you are projecting onto this. It has to do with images and things that we've seen like in Hollywood and what these tropes symbolize. And they communicate in these messages. They've been building upon a theme, you know, like we talk about whenever they film Mexico, they use a very similar lens that they use when they film. It can be post-production too. They film the Middle East. Everything looks fucking yellow and stuff. Like, oh yeah, it's the desert. Russia is always, they use like gray, blue. They make sure to let you know that it's winter time all the time there. I guess it's not actually, as you've seen, people would vacation for a few months out of the year on the, you know, Black Sea, and it's like bikinis and snow cones and shit. Who knew, right, that was communism? But anyway, so you have this this tendency to want to. So just to recap, we can kind of, since we've kind of, I think, explored it well, and then I'll look at the questions now. We'll pause and then we'll look at the questions. So prepare your questions now. I'll be looking at them in about a minute. Just put them. I don't know that I made a comment thread or not. I probably did. Just I'll find it. So a lot of people build up a lot of their thinking based on prior existing theories of work and stuff. So the idea that like the East and the West are actually in this controlled paradigm fight by those these bloodlines and shit, Rothschild or whatever, that they control the whole earth, okay, is maybe an alternate reality fantasy that the Rothschild family has, and certainly those were their goals. And they say a lot of things that the news reports a lot of things that aren't actually true or don't make a lot of sense when they talk about some of this economic investment into China to the degree that it might determine their desired outcomes or what have you. So there's a lot of misinformation about that. The reality is that the Eastern, you know, you talk about secret societies and power elites. When the communists came to power in China, this wasn't like a plan. This wasn't like a plot of the Jesuits or something, or like Freemasons in China. Okay, these are exoterically, it's like this Chinese version of a Russian version of a German ideology, right? But actually, and it was not imported by Jesuits or what have you. But what you did have, and this is what we learned from, okay, is a fractured elite, and they've been backing different warlords, these families, these important, powerful, wealthy families of China, and they eventually get down to backing either the nationalists or the communists. And none of the wealthy families in China that backed the communists like had some fear that they were going to be, expropriated or something, because that wasn't the political, that wasn't the platform of the Chinese communists. That they were, they thought that they, you have to, the theory is just different. We won't digress into understanding two-stage theory in OG Third International Marxism-Leninism. But actually, despite that, these revolutionary situations thrust the proletarian party into power, that doesn't mean that the basics for socialist development, well, the basis of for socialist development might exist, but maybe all the things that they'll need later on don't exist or whatever. You see, they play kind of a little fast and loose with this idea. Since the entire concept was that the Marxist revolutions take place in the most advanced capitalist countries first. So they're always trying to explain, why this ended up the opposite. And in so doing, what you actually wound up with in China is a very good case study in different types of national unification projects, like when the elites struggling with these relationships that they have, like within themselves and their own families, of parts of the family being integrated into the capital flow structures that benefit the British Empire and are connected even to the opium trade, or rely upon the keeping the population drugged up, so that China was small, divided, and weak. And it was, there were always, there were, there are always people, like, who was it? The father of Armand Hammer and others, and Armand Hammer himself, that they just don't view. They didn't view these communist revolutions as some kind of horrible affront to the possibility of investing and making money. They just saw them as other governments, and hey, hit them up and make a deal. So guess what they did, And Russia being a country, or the Soviet Union being a country, it was doing all kinds of regular trade with Western countries. It just they were constantly in this rubric of being constantly, like, basically what we call sanctions today. But there was the Anglo-Soviet trade deal of 1927 that made a lot of, probably despite a lot of games that England was playing with their position towards the Third Reich and the potential of going that way, probably the relationships that consolidated after the 1927 Anglo-Soviet trade deal guaranteed that the Soviet Union and the British Empire would actually be on the same side in a world war. So this is the historical lens required to understanding Russia's position today, right? This was what we talked about earlier today, was the political terrain of Russia and the divisions that had been made sort of inorganically, or aspects of it, like copy-pasted over organic developments, if that makes sense, because you have legitimate discontent, right? And people might agree with the things that are wrong, but a positive agenda about which way to fix things and how things should look in the future is going to be based upon your orientation right now. So the U.S. strategy in destroying the Soviet Union wasn't just to get behind liberal democratic reformers like Yeltsin or something like that. They had neo-Nazis that they were supporting, neo-Nazi groups. So they were supporting like Nazi fascist groups, liberal, kind of human rightsy, kind of freedom of speechy, freedom of assembly kind of people. They were supporting all kinds of, which is fine. It's just a full spectrum dominance stance to take. So for Russia to come back, they had to make a sort of Russian sovereigntist, in line with Surkov's ideas, kind of Russian sovereigntist version of all these things. So, in other words, like, how do you manage a post-Soviet political discourse where you have some resurgent legitimacy of what was kind of used to be just, wacko, whatever kind of monarchist channels. And then now suddenly this is more legitimate, right? This idea. And then, when the modern Russia, when they first start to adopt like their heraldry and their state, their state seal or their symbol or whatever, their crest, coat of arms, all these things, harken back to the kind of the czarist period, doesn't it? But then at the same time, when it comes to what Russian patriotism means, it's indivisible from the Great Patriotic War and the Soviet experience in World War II, you see. And so you're going to so this is like how are they navigating monarchist tendencies, sort of like not communist in the sense of like, they could debate, Lenin versus Kamenev or something like that. But, just patriotic sense of the Soviet time was a good time and this is we're proud of or whatever type of thing. And the associations with victory and this fight against this Russophobia that comes up out of that comes up out of Europe time and time again. It's like this digestive process and it has to belch it up. So indeed you can see that that the Russophobic tendencies are all aimed at kind of the soft power thing. So just so that when people say things like, oh, like there's corrupt Russian, you're like, oh yeah, of course, like all Russians are corrupt or something like that. Just kind of things that are common sense that kind of get just planted into the culture that are really innocuous. You're not really aware of it because it's written, it's like just uttered by a random dude in a TV show. It's written kind of into the fabric of things. And so it's very innocuous. You don't want to use the same word too many times, but you know what I mean? It's hard to detect unless you're looking for it and you're like, wow, they really throw these things in everywhere. And then, and based on that, then you've got some idea that Putin really is a dictator. So then you're like, oh, everything that happens, like people, like for example, like with the maybe having to wear a mask or employees in different spheres with the vaccination stuff. These were things that happened at the level of the oblasts and the city mayor, city council stuff. It's just like the United States, like under Trump. I mean, just think about. Imagine somebody saying, oh yeah, like, well, look at all these states in the country and had they had all these, places doing mandatory vaccine schools and all this universities, workplaces, hospitals. And, so this is what's going on in Trump's America. And any American like, oh no, it's more complicated than that because we have a federal system and blah, 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 blah. Oh, well, Russia's a federal system too. So there you go. Just to understand. So you have a federal system and then the guy running it, nominally the chief executive, the executive of the state, is supposedly like a dictator. We readily accept that. Also, because we've been told that a dictator is a president for life and not actually a person acting with the full scope of executive powers during an emergency period for like 6 months or something like that. So in many ways, parliamentary republics where governments are formed out of weak coalitions, and also in the two-party American system, you don't really have a method of accountability except to remove those people and put in other people whose campaign financing comes from the same people that you just tried to remove. And some people would say that this is a type of dictatorship. It's certainly a type of class dictatorship. But having someone that wins elections because they get things done is not a dictatorship. The dictatorship is not the length of time that you're in office. Roosevelt, 12 years or whatever it was it 14, 12, whatever it was, wasn't a dictator. He was just too popular. That's what happens with populists when they mobilize the farmers, when they build a coalition out of different segments of the deplorables that the past machines had kind of set upon each other. And populist breakthrough always goes in the direction of building, well, people sometimes say this was Gramsci, but actually, Gramsci was making another reference. But yeah, I think it even could go back to Proudhon. But it's just a very strange thing. It's a very strange phenomenon. Let's take 30 seconds and get into some questions. All right, and we're back. So let's make sure we got this good. Yeah. Questions. All right. So question. XF, I've noticed a Catholicization of the US recently between Roe v. Wade decided by five Catholics. Then the next young talented politician is DeSantis, who's Catholic. I think this monkeypox thing too seems very Vatican-like in its social engineering agenda. Plus, if these shots do impair fertility, that may be a means to introduce CRISPR as the control mechanism for oligarchs. But the Vatican seems likely to return to prominence as a voice of morality in modern science, positioning themselves against corporate America. I heard you mention Opus Dei once. What's the connection here? Am I onto some grand trend? Well, I appreciate the question. What you're asking about really is like where the Vatican fits into the kind of overall globalist agenda. And this is a process that goes back to the reformation, counter-reformation, the Inquisition, and how Western Christianity was forever changed again. for like a third time or something like that. And when you look at sort of the things that happened after Martin Luther in Northern Europe, and then how the real impetus of the push against the church in Northern Europe was that the church had the Latin church had a very strange approach to actually things like sorcery and esotericism, and they had people in the church doing things like necromancy, which is a form of sorcery, because these were practices that indigenous populations in Europe had even going on, you know, in the 16 and 1700s, right? That were supposedly from ancient Roman times. There's a view that the ancient Roman times may have been more recent by numbers of years, right, to 500 years ago, in proximity to 500 years ago, more like 1,000 years ago. You have the length or history of the church then itself becomes another question of debate. But the main power groups in the West have already exercised control over many aspects of the Vatican. So while there's still a Catholicism that is in the church and in the theologians and as expressed that comes out through these different things at times and just the different writers and thinkers the church still has, and the kind of, you know, for example, Pope Ratzinger, when he was younger, a lot of his stuff was on Joaquin Fiore, who was sort of a church writer who was sort of looking at the development of this concept of what direction the church is eventually going to go into, right? And one of those ideas is that he almost kind of took some things from contemporary philosophy, maybe even things that, you know, Hegel in many ways is sort of copy-pasted out of early Christianity. Most of Hegelian ideas are actually, you know, Greek, things that might have later been called Gnostic, heretical, but stuff that was in the first 2, 3, 4 centuries of Christianity, in great number, maybe even predominance, actually, certainly existent in great numbers. And a lot of those things actually continued on in the church for a long time, in the Western church, and kept coming back. And a lot of these things laid the foundation for the Renaissance. And so, in other words, the Latin church, or the Roman church, if you would, actually had a very open approach to playing with a lot of these different traditions that were, you know, pre-Christian or even anti-Christian, or even things that were strictly forbidden in scripture. With all that, there is an independence of the organization of the Catholic Church, but the relationship between it and the, let's say, the globalists, right, it mirrors the very same development of power in Europe over the past, let's say, 1,000 years or 1,200 years. So it follows that same trend of power moving from the south and moving northward. So a lot of the direction of the things that happen in the Vatican, despite its degree of, through its complexity and through the different competing groups and through its esoteric and cut off and different hermetically sealed, you know, areas of power in the church, nevertheless, they exist in this environment of heavy infiltration and heavy guidance, or, you know, impetus to follow the transatlantic agenda. And that's been, I mean, and we said that's not a new thing. And this isn't like a Vatican II thing. This is like, you know, the German Nazis were able to completely co-opt the Vatican and the church. So you have, again, Northern Europe exerting power over Southern Europe, right? That's a thing that comes up again, but the trend is going in that direction. So it's really the Anglo-Dutch banking families. Some of them are Christian, some of them are not, nominally, right? And they exert control, sort of political control and different controls over the Vatican. They make sure that even though the Vatican kind of plays this game of seeming like it's, you know, in the Vatican II context, like it's very liberal, right? And it's very this and very that. And, you know, let's have communion with like acrobatic Buddhist monks and things like that. And let's have, let's like rebrand what a gay priest is so that we can just say it's something else without changing what they're doing with little kids. They have a lot of weird things going on in that, in the organizations which make up the Catholic Church of the West, the Latin Church. But number one, or, you know, following on that, number one of this is the, you know, as a physical organization in the world, right? To what extent could they really escape the overall preponderance of the dominance of, you know, of the new ways that power and money were developed in the past, you know, 3 and 4 centuries with the industrial revolutions and finance and things like that. So the Vatican is not that powerful in terms of setting the agenda, but they are useful as part of the agenda. Does that make sense? And that doesn't mean there is no possibility for the church to experience regeneration and change tack or whatever. And I think that it would tend to, I mean, it might mean a lot of destruction of institutions in the church and things like that. Like the money changer tables getting flipped over, the bank of Vatican Bank or whatever, right? So that's kind of weird, but on the whole of it, the issue with understanding the Vatican is that even the movements that are approved by the Anglo-Dutch sort of controller mechanisms are that those movements are also very transatlantic. Even though they're anti-liberal and they're like hardcore Catholic traditionalists, you talk about SSPX and things like this, right? Like, what's their attitude towards orthodoxy? Oh, they're heretics. Let's smash them, right? Maybe even a military invasion is some kind of act of God if it's going to, you know, destroy the Orthodox Church so that, you know, Russia can be consecrated to the Virgin Mary. The prophecy, you know, the Fatima prophecy. So that's the kind of the thing. That's how the traditionalists of the church are weaponized. It's a total scam. I mean, you can even, and I'm sorry that for some reason you have a religion like, you know, like the Latin Church that's, you know, several thousand years old, and suddenly the whole fucking fixation of the freaking religion is around some shit in the Iberian Peninsula like 100 years ago. You know, lick some balls. Seriously. That's fake. That's so fake. The whole century of the church is fake already by then, really. I mean, the whole church is fake by the 20th century. So it's like, and the woman who became, who was like the nun, they changed her. Like, look at her teeth, look at the whole thing. Because with the mystery and the things that were revealed were different things. Okay. And also, what's up with apparitions? What does the Bible say about apparitions? That's kind of weird to have a Marian apparition, to be honest with you. But anyway, not a theological discussion. I don't have like strong views about this, by the way. Just what I said. but I think, you know, it's but it's but you know, you can understand. Just think about it from my point of view. I mean, you know, like I come, you know, I my mom's, you know, I come from a Catholic family, and I understand like the syndromes and the things going on with in that organization. But the thing is that what you need to understand, Jonathan, is that the American tradition of conspiracy theories, a lot of anti-Catholic thinking comes from Protestant conspiracy theories from America. And you know, I don't know if you're, you know, white or Anglo or Saxon Protestant or whatever, but or where you're from or anything like that. I know nothing about you, but that for whatever reason, I'm not saying, I'm not trying to we had a little just cut off. I think there was an internet cut off. This is a spotty internet connection. I just jumped off one device and onto another. I don't know if this is going to stick or be more reliable. Anyway, the final idea being that a lot of the thinking that the Catholics run things is actually an old boys club conspiracy theory of the Protestants. Of the old boys network of Protestants. And kind of like, for example, like when JFK, who was Catholic, right, was running, they made it be like this whole thing, oh, does that mean the Vatican, all these Vatican conspiracy theories, the Vatican going to control Washington, all these Vatican conspiracy theories kind of came up again, okay? Vatican conspiracy theories, as a category, by the way, is very problematic because some of them are true and some of them are yet to be established. So I don't, you know, I don't, unfortunately, language, we are compelled to generalize the structure of language and maps and such. But my view is not anti-Catholic, just to be clear. It's not my religion, but it's not alien to me. I just, you know, it's just my own understanding of things. But as a person generally sympathetic to human things that have functioned, you know, better than dysfunction or better than sort of organized chaos, that we kind of see this chaoticism, this planned chaos of the world today by the elites. Almost any religious tradition has something valuable in comparison. And I don't claim to know, you know, definitively about how all these things work for other people. I only know how this seems to be working for me. Where growing up, you know, seeing like religious imagery of a particular type, of the type in Christianity, especially more artistic or, you know, iconographic oriented Christianities, whether it be the Latin or Greek churches. And I like that. I like the cultural aspects of it and the ornamentation and also the icons and iconography and frescoes and things like that. And those things were like familiar to me and comfortable to me. And for whatever reason, the nature of my soul and its appearance at this time and place
However it was that I landed, you know, born to the parents that I was, and in that context is a mystery to me, but I'm open-minded to any number of potential explanations, as exercises that might lead to, you know, other thinking about other things. But it's really just all about a search for the real problem is that we are the ones living in the distorted time. We are the ones living in the time when things that are true look like lies and things that are lies look like true. And part of for that getting that to work has been this false ideology called progress. And part of that belief is that thinkers and, you know, mathematicians and theologians and philosophers of the past were like more primitive, and that the complexity and truth, the both the complexity and truthfulness of the things that we think about today are increasing in time, right? And actually, it's very interesting because there's a very great parallel where Christopher Hitchens, the Trotskyite turned liberal warmonger atheist, who's mostly known for stupid debates with religious people, but as an atheist, but if it wasn't Hitchens, it was that other bloke, but equally as annoying. But he was sort of put on the spot, and he basically was, because one of the things that they talk about in the neo-Darwinian construct and kind of these different hard problems that they've hit, but they don't talk about, they just lie and like move on. Like one of these hard problems in the Darwinian model, like has to do with that. One of the suppositions is that over time that the organisms are becoming, genetically more complex. Okay. And anyway, so it was basically, Darwin rested a lot of what he said on certain things. And then, of course, the neo-Darwinian paradigm isn't necessarily reliant on sort of Darwin's, things that sort of Darwin said, like things that were contingent. There were a number of things that Darwin said, look, if this turns out to be true, then the whole theory's out the door. And one of those was that the fundamentals of life were simple. If that didn't turn out to be true, then that's a problem. And then connected to that is that life, therefore, as it has evolved, is also becoming increasingly complex, right? It turns out that, you know, the most primitive, you know, single-celled bacteria still have 5 million different independent working parts, which are genetically coded for certain shapes, just like little gears and levers and things, more complex than a Boeing 747. And without any one of those parts, the thing would not function as designed. And then you would argue maybe it could function or whatever, but, you know, there's a level of, you know, what they call irreducible complexity. So, I think that the church and kind of footed in religion, I think that there is some that there's, God works in mysterious ways. And when I think about the sort of some of the theories about the conflict or contest between Ratzinger and the Argentine bouncer, is whether or not, Ratzinger is still really the Pope, whether actually Ratzinger still has power, whether the we just having a very bad, very bad connection. I'm going to wrap it up, even though we could get through more questions. But because if it goes out again, I'm just going to say goodnight. But I'll look at the questions here. Pedro Silva says, my grandma was from the Fatima region in the same age as the Little Shepherds, and no one from the area ever believed that BS fabricated by the Salazar fascist regime. Yeah, and it's become a thing of the church. It's just a thing. Question. Why aren't the Russians and Chinese bullhorning Spygate, Hunter's laptop, the authoritarian slide of U.S. domestic politics? She and Putin should sanction Hitler, sorry, Hunter, Paul, Pelosi, Hines, all these neocon libs knee-deep in Ukraine and Chinese shenanigans. Yeah, I think they actually have, and actually the stuff coming out of Russia, the report, they're going to do decisive things like that, actually, with the biological lab. You'll remember that they kind of bury the lead sometimes, and they kind of, probably the Russians and their information work should probably even increase some of the repetition. They actually are doing all that. They showed that, you know, beyond Burisma, totally beyond that, that Hunter and the same, you know, family, the Bidens, were doing the biological labs, the illegal research on the bioweapons, and they were selling the clients of that information, where their clients were the Department of Defense. Isn't that interesting? And the Democratic Party, the DNC, was a named client of the Hunter Biden family owned, or the Biden family owned, bioweapons lab in Ukraine. So that stuff is, you know, I mean, to the extent that people are aware of that, or, you know, no wonder there's such a push to block RT or whatever from all these different countries, because I think they are talking about a lot of the stuff. Spygate and all this, I mean, it's going to be a long time, if ever, that the public knows, you know, really what happened with some of the Spygate from a couple years ago. You know, we talked about it, and people know what I think about that. But with Patrick Byrne and Maria Butina and all of that. So, but yeah, there was, you know, I would recommend, Jonathan, because you're suggesting that considering their history, it would have been in Russia's interest decades ago to co-opt right-wing elements of the Vatican, blah, blah, blah. You know, I would advise that a better approach to understanding the world is that instead of trying to look at, because this is what I do, okay? Instead of looking at, like, what should have done, because that's not actually what we're not actually doing what we think we're doing when we do that. We're actually showing that we don't understand why the things that happened. So what you really want to do is explain why what happened. Because think about the things that are built into your statement, right? Like, you probably don't even speak Russian, but yet you understand this great strategic thing that the Russians are not figuring out and blah, 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 blah. And they, you know, if you were there, you would have done it, but you understand where that goes. So you're probably absolutely wrong, that it would have been in their interest, that it would have been feasible. Feasibility and interest are also inherently connected, right? Because how much you have to do to get something done. The right wing elements of the church are the most Slavophobic. The right-wing elements of the church and, like, SSPX, these are, these people think, these are like the Teutonic Order thinking. So, it's not necessary, you know, it's, Russia's strategic position on the religious wars has been a number of defeats and setbacks. Actually, it's actually the Vatican that projects power in the Orthodox Church. In actually, right now, at the in Constantinople. So it's actually a lot of problems with autocephalous movements being kind of recognized by Fanar and things like this. So, you know, church politics, what do they say? We don't talk about things so that there's no doubt, so that there's doubt about, you know, whether we understand. The minute we talk about things, it's clear we don't understand the subject. No, you don't want to, you know, the thing with the ability to subvert CIA influence in the Vatican. Russia has been using their intelligence agency to subvert CIA influence in the Kremlin. There was a CIA station, like listening station, like underneath the Kremlin or some shit like that. It was at some point in time, it was actually very thoroughly compromised. So, and that's the kind of thing, dude, that we're talking about here. That I'm not trying to be personal. I'm just using this as product. I'm using your, you know, you're cool. I'm just talking about, I'm using, you know, your comment as product and shit. You know, no, dude, no, it's not like that at all. The Vatican has, look at their way that they've done in Ukraine, how they transformed Ukraine over centuries. There were people who were Orthodox and thought that they were going to an Orthodox church their whole lives, and they weren't. Isn't that interesting? So anyway, very good. Sorry for our interruptions and the problems with the quality earlier. Looks like it may have settled out a little bit. So I'm gonna try to round out my concluding thought. So the foundations of Surkov's sovereign democracy to work, you needed to do this ideological work and creating in modern Russia a difference between the nationalists and the patriots. Because Russian nationalism came to mean little Russia and came to mean the ethnic Russians, which actually occupy a smaller space if you define Russianness in a limited way. So, and that is actually a CIA and National Endowment for Democracy and State Department program to divide Russia into smaller states. So extreme Russian nationalism is actually Western financed and Western originated. Actually, you know, the whole Westphalian concept of nation states and all this was sort of Westphalian, and then there was all these there were elements of masonry and secret societies that kind of got behind the nation building projects and stuff as a whole phase of history, way of organizing things, way of organizing territories and identities, so that the dynasties or the nobilities that historically were associated with the sovereignty of that land were no longer associated instantly. So now, you know, so that you actually have this concept of nations. Not you meaning from the word natio, right? Born. So I think that those different political positions, it's a war of these, how would you say, full spectrum domination approaches, where you actually have to control all the pieces on the terrain, of the political terrain. And then you have to make the thing that had the basis to be the state, into the one that holds the least squares. What am I saying? Well, so the, in 1990, right? In 1990, the West controlled, and this is a thing that is going to be difficult for people all over walks of life to understand, okay? Number one, there was an orthodoxy that was against the, you know, the Soviet kind of like state-sponsored orthodoxy that kind of Stalin pseudo-restored, very difficult, complex question, in what many activists in the church today describe as a painful period in the church's history. But these, you know, anti-Soviet elements of the Orthodox Church in the diaspora were weaponized by NATO, in fact. So that's another painful thing to talk about if you want to talk about painful things. And then another painful thing to talk about was how, you know, every walk of life and thing in thing was weaponized by the West against the Soviet Union. But the truth is that these things aren't like, the Soviet Union wasn't like a paradise or something. So you have real existing problems and people having a real negative reaction that's a legitimate, you know, outcome of real existing problems in that society. Right, but the solutions that we think that exist are kind of, a lot of that is kind of what gets painted out there for us. And then it gets hard to start separating our analysis of the problems with our analysis of the preferred solutions. And so what happened in the Soviet Union is that basically the people who wanted Russia to become smaller and smaller and for then all those pieces to be integrated, i.e. owned or controlled by historical Western powers. Okay, that was the agenda. That's what didn't happen. But that was the preferred agenda. That was the aim. With that, in that period, okay, that's where they were happiest, the West, in, let's say, 1995 or something like this with Russia. And at that time, like the kind of the football hooligans and skinheads and neo-Nazi stuff, ultras, right? Ultras hooligans, ultra-nationalist hooligans, these were gang. We talk about from the perspective of intelligence, counterinsurgency, and developing gangs and things like that. So they had, the West had developed gangs that were Nazi gangs, right? Skinhead gangs. And so like the far right stuff and things that would get into even like ancient Russian history, especially kind of like the Viking aspects of Russian history, would kind of tie into kind of German and Nazi Viking, you know, Hyperborea shit and all this whatnot. So, so the Russians had to divide all that out. Okay, so one asset of the Russian sort of ideological intelligence police sphere of control has been Alexander Dugin, and he's kind of been important to kind of take the people in Russia who originally these ideas, these kind of super far right 1930s German type ideas, right? But kind of maybe those who might have been the more intellectuals of that kind of maybe people who might be looking at things through a sympathetic but largely academic lens, like, oh, you know, untangling the fact that there was, you know, that Nazi ideology was actually always very flimsy or things like this. It was never really fleshed out. There wasn't like a single fascism, for example, in the same way that there was more like a single Marxism-Leninism. Like there was more like a single communism. Yeah, you have Trotskyism, Maoism, and all this Stalinism, all these different stuff. But, you know, compared to fascism as a phenomenon, fascism is much more heterodox, right? So that made it a little bit easier to kind of divide, because you can just change, it's much easier to kind of change the stream of a narrative of something as heterodox as fascism or neo-fascism. So Dugin was important, I think, in kind of splitting that up too, because now if you're like Russian and you're interested like in, you know, ancient history and mysticism, and maybe we talked about like this attempt to maybe reconstruct what maybe would have been, you know, the fascist intelligentsia or things that would have lent itself to that, or the foundations of it, Rene Guénon or whatever in the traditionalism, or, you know, so you have a lot of this floating around. And so then Dugin is therefore like a pole, so that Russians who would be interested in that aren't recruited into Western Nazi structures. Actually, so you can see this, what I'm talking about is not conjecture. It rarely ever is with this. We always have receipts. So, for example, one of the, you know, right sectors, ideologists, was a younger woman, who was a Heideggerian philosopher, master or doctor of Heideggerian philosophy from Ukraine, University of Kiev, and was also a lecturer. And like with Arestovich, right, he's there as younger, right, they're there with Dugin and stuff like that, you see, because people interested in ideas are interested in ideas. But the Russian attempt was to co-opt an aspect of the right, but for its own, because of this, we're talking about this foursquare of the post-Soviet space and who controlled the political narratives, and entering into the story. Like if you just said, okay, day one, what's the story? You know, January 1st, 1994, right? The West controlled the far right, like the kind of like the Nazi-ish far right in Russia. They controlled the Westerners, like the Western liberal reformists, you know, the market people, whether you were kind of like a human rightsy person, like a little bit lefty-ish, or if you were like a business finance or a market guy or whatever, you would have been in that same actual camp in Russia at that time. The market liberal human rights reformers, that was kind of a thing, right? Then another square is the Orthodox Church and the there's a kind of a germ or a cell, rather, more like a nucleus, potential to infiltrate the Western imported far right. You know, you get this potential through kind of these concepts or older organizations and things, or rebirths like Pamyat and things like this that redefine, that are kind of part of redefining the political space in post-Soviet collapse in the middle 90s. And you had, of course, like the National Bolshevik Party with all their kind of stunts. You had, you know, Liminov. He had been in New York for some time. He wrote kind of a funny novel. He was actually kind of celebrated a little bit by the New York Times in a few reviews as being like kind of a, almost like a Yevtushenko, or like a Soviet kind of dissident creative and stuff, living in New York in the gay community and in the artistic community. Then he goes back and becomes like this kind of Leon Trotsky-looking super far-right leader of this National Bolshevik movement, or party, rather. Ends up getting banned and stuff like that. There's a really funny story about this black kid from the Netherlands who got into it and learned Russian, and he's like a meme himself. It's great, man. There's so many funny things associated with that. But all of that was part of recapturing all these different areas of terrain. For the most mainstream, the biggest success of the terrain that made Surkov's sovereign democracy possible was really the being able to successfully bifurcate, right, the concept of modernization with westernization. That modernization and westernization meaning we're in the surrender position of needing to learn new manners of us needing to learn how they do things. So we're always going to be behind that, right? So in other words, because the overall, in totality, the Western ideology, the Western liberal ideology in totality, even though it's maybe unexpressed discursively or textually rather in the tomes, it's not there, right? But the context and the reality and the subtext that's being highly projected is this, right? That that liberal modernity has permanent winners, that it is the international community countries, and they will always be, you know, more advanced, more humane, more politically correct, more innovative. So whatever you're doing is not good enough. So it's a type of, not racism wouldn't be the word, but it can be likened to a type of chauvinism, if you would. And this is actually the basis for which they, you know, hit countries and say, oh, you violated human rights, now you're sanctioned and things like that, you see. Or, now you have to deal in carbon credits, so you can, here are your credits, and if you don't use them, you can sell them back to us. So all of that taken together is how Russia was having to navigate, you know. Energy is one of their biggest assets, and many things were weaponized that you would think were innocuous or even true. Like, I'll tell you, for example, okay, this idea that like a secret new energy source that was going to be super cheap and hyper abundant was going to be released by the West, right? That was being held back. Okay, so the Russian leadership either was convinced or the people involved, their job was to, you know, to pretend to be convinced, or they were convinced, whatever that was going on, right, in the Yeltsin years, was this, that, like, you know, if you raise the price, Russia, if you guys raise the price, then it's just going to speed up research into, you know, these new renewable energies that are right around the corner. Turned out that was a lie. All these things never, you know, like, solar panels, you need a whole fucking football field of them just to keep your computer running. You need, I'm exaggerating, but not by much. The wind stuff doesn't work. It's actually, there's a lot of, it is, some of the actual, you know, proposed, admitted mathematics of like when these investments get returns and then the rate of those returns and when they start trickling, it's like you are so far into the future that you would have gone through several paradigm fucking shifts in your whole scientific approach to the question by the time that the returns on these fucking, you know, these windmills actually pay back, if ever. I mean, it's actually connected to a whole different concept that you actually, that they don't pay back or something. By making the energy costly, you're delimiting the rate of development of new technologies. That's really what they want to do. So because they actually are trying to limit new technologies, and they actually aren't trying to go forward, okay, you can see that the Russians started to game this out, and through in laying down the foundation to make sovereign democracy as part of their, you know, foreign policy, to have it in the constitution, this is what we didn't connect, okay, to have it in the Russian constitution that Russia does not have an ideology, right, but simultaneously that thing that's not an ideology is called sovereign democracy because it's defined by the things using the same discursive framework that describes Western democratic capitalist regimes or republics or societies or whatever the fuck you call them. So because of that, right, because in the mindset, in the worldview of liberal modernity, right, liberal modernity is not an ideology, even though it is. that's just the default. That's just normal. That's just like when you're a fish, you don't notice the fucking water, right? You are in liberal modernity. You don't notice the liberal modernity. You watch a movie, a colorized reel from the Third Reich, like, oh my God, they were such Nazis and all those flags. Okay, and for you, it's crazy because you're not in that water, right? But you don't see the ideology. I mean, you do because you're listening and we're all friends, but many people do not see the water that they're in as fish. They don't see that it's an ideology. And so Russia manipulated that fact because in the creation of the new constitution, the old new constitution, right, in the 90s, there were anti-Russian forces at work. And they needed to make sure that Russia would have it hard-coded that they were not allowed to have a belief system that the state represented or that the state was pursuing. And, you know, well, why not? Well, we in the West don't have a belief system. You know, we just believe in the truth, right? Like, the truth? Well, what do you mean by that, sir? Well, you know, true things. Not like, you know, Russia fake news. They believe in fake news things, and we believe in true things. So likewise, liberal modernity is not an ideology. So sovereign democracy is couched within the discursive framework of liberal democracy. This is all connected to our understanding, explaining to people Russia's real trajectory, and it isn't that, like, Putin is a, you know, Klaus Schwab sleeper agent, or you see what I'm saying? Oh, man. If you had, like, Klaus Schwab and Putin in the same room together, that whole Dr. Evil shit would disappear real fucking fast. Did you see Obama sitting across from Putin? Remember when they're, like, serving up the drink out of the traditional, out of the boot and everything? It's Russians hosting it, and Obama's, like, sitting there, and, like, he's trying to, you know, he's trying to assess, like, the power situation. He's doing his, you know, his intuitive kind of body language and things that relate to the situation, yet he can't control it, and he starts fidgeting with his socks and things like that, and he looks like he's pleading with them after fidgeting with his socks. And, like, Putin's just sitting there looking like kind of like Tony Montana, definitely unfazed, complete stoic mode, kind of slouched back, just kind of almost smirking, like, is this guy, does he just keep talking and more talking the more nervous he gets, just talk, talk, talk? It was insane. I don't expect that Schwab's whole, you know, fucking Dr. Evil, or, you know, what was the guy, Dr. Nauer or whatever, from Shutter Island, you know, you enter in at the point of the traum. So, you know, that's the whole thing with that, man. So the biggest thing for Russia to do was to divide the concept of, like, modern and the future and development from the West. That was huge. That was the main thing. So that's why, actually, like, the Putin faction is the, like, the main... the main, what they project as kind of their main thing, you know, despite that many, let's say, retirees and stuff historically voted in his party, also for the communists, they're the second or third largest party in the Duma. But this is just the inherited stuff from, you know, how the social security system was set up. So if you were, like, a public sector employee and now you have a retirement or whatever, you're probably going to be a Communist Party voter. I mean, that's how it was even in non-communist countries. That's how it was for decades in countries like Italy or Greece or France, you know, all throughout the 60s and 70s for people who know Europe. So that's the real lay of the land. And Putin is the product of many different forces in Russia, but I would contend also a plan that goes back to the war games that showed that the Soviet Union was much more liable to be destroyed by subversion, demoralization and subversion than a military operation. I mean, you had, you know, the impossibility for the naval powers, the U.S., Britain, right, the naval powers, Western Europe, the colonial naval powers, to win a land war in Eurasia. Like, that's not going to happen. Like, everyone saw how the Chinese war with the Japanese went, or the Korean War, things like that, or Vietnam. You just don't win those. And so where a lot of the efforts were put into subversion, and we talked about how they set up the dual currency system so that corrupt Soviet bureaucrats could transfer that kind of production cream off the top, the inefficiencies and the corruption, and actually monetize those into a parallel banking system out of Cyprus and Switzerland, so that when the kind of Soviet Union, when they turned the lights off for that, that's how all these oligarchs came from. They were the, you know, the guys or the sons of the guys who were the Soviet enterprise managers themselves. So when we studied the destruction of the Soviet Union with particular interest at the university, you know, there are the locations of the places that were targeted for to be, you know, privatized, or really we mean de-sovereigntized, sold to foreigners or foreign consortiums, okay? When that, if you look at the map of all of the Soviet era enterprises, right, that were targeted for, you know, reforms by the Yeltsin period, so that basically Westerners could buy up these assets, okay? That is an identical map to the nuclear strike map of the strategic places to hit with, you know, 1,000 nuclear missiles. So the destruction of the Soviet Union economically, the in terms of the actual the receipts on that, and the who was doing what, when you get into that, this was identical to a military operation in terms of its intended economic consequences. Okay, that's the reality that Russia is emerging out of, like, when, you know, Putin comes onto the scene in the year 2000. Okay, so you know, what the West would have liked, lustration or decommunization in Russia, to work towards demoralizing all Russian patriots, since we talked about that point of reference of the Great Patriotic War, World War II, right, is within the rubric of that kind of Soviet period, right? So you have that nostalgia for that as well. And all that said, okay, that doesn't mean that there isn't a sort of antipathy towards Western iterations of conservatism. Okay, it's just that from the language of American political science, and as we explained in our morning show, this surprises many people. Okay, the communist and the communist rule and the communist thing in Russia during the time of the 90s is described by today's liberal political scientists and today's liberal media as right wing, that the communists are the right wing. Now, if for you right wing means austerity and privatization and let's say union busting or things like that, then no, that will make no sense at all what I've just said. Of course not. I know that. But you had the Russian Revolution at, you know, the end of the teens, at the end of World War One. Okay. So by the 1970s and 1980s, like, the Soviet bureaucracy was the conservative power. Like, the communist power was the conservative power. You might say ossified, but they were conserving and doing things to try to hold on to power. See, many people would define conservative as those things that people in power do to hold on to power. Isn't that interesting? That's from the language of the left. That's why I keep saying we all speak different languages. I speak all of these languages. I'm fluent in multiple political languages. I could pass a Turing test. You know, you have to be able to speak these different languages so you can translate them when people are talking in real time. Like, I can listen to Michael Parenti and agree with 90% of what he's saying because I have a real-time translator in my head, you see. I can listen to anyone on the right and translate what they say. I can still disagree with certain points, but I won't be deprived of the opportunity to agree with them based upon their language alone. Okay. Understanding political language and the notions and what is at the root of political thinking, the root of the sort of the gist of it or the thrust of it, even at a deep, unpronounced level, almost at a unconscious level, right? And then the particulars of a political ideology or political program are kind of like the expression of that thing within the givens of the time and place, right? But there's a kind of innate aspect of those in any society. That's what we talked about, the origins of the evolutionary origins, perhaps, or whatever they are, you know, ingrained or built in origins of differences in human beings that lead to those different, you know, political projects, different ideologies, right? Based upon differences in innate differences between human beings. I mean, individuals within the tribe, like, you don't sleep at night. That's called a disorder today. But 1,000 years ago, you definitely needed somebody who didn't sleep at night, because their job was to make sure that other people didn't get fucking eaten or stabbed, right? Who's at the walls? Oh, they're coming, right? Like Paul Revere. Wasn't that at night? So just think about that kind of stuff. You need the vigilance. There's nothing, what I'm trying to say is that even though there was a lot of popular opposition to the Soviet rule, different sectors of society were actually opposing different things. In fact, some people wanted more of the things that other people wanted less of, but yet they all would have been called anti-Soviet dissidents. You see what I'm saying? So it was a very heterogeneous group. Like we said, you had Western Nerds, liberal modernizers, you had Nazis, you had Orthodox, right? You had monarchists and kind of like the Orthodox monarchist networks. You had all of these that were weaponized by NATO. And so Russia had to recapture those positions. In other words, we're no longer going to be a one-party communist state. We're now going to have, you know, four or five kind of major parties that represent the major views in society. All of these have been views, and kind of the political positions are kind of synthetically generated by the West, right? Within these concepts, right? Like the idea that to be a modernizer means that you're also a Westernizer. So, or the idea that you are conservative and patriotic means that you're, doesn't mean, like, right, we're saying, look how it doesn't mean that, right? But separating from meaning of, let's say, nationalistic in the way that Russia talks about nationalism. And Russia talking about nationalism in this way today is the most anti-nationalist discourse I've ever heard from. The Soviet period was more pro-nationalist. Now, the truth is that the reality is that if by nationalism you mean sovereigntist movements, then Russia is supporting all the sovereigntist movements, right? But if by nationalism you mean whatever it is that NATO has cooked up into a soup called nationalism, that's something else too. I think that one of the things is that you have to keep in mind is that at the beginning of the 20th century, the nationalism of developing countries could be both right-wing and socialist and left-wing at the same time. Even the IRA, right? So you just have a lot of this, a lot of problems with political language that we continually have to address in the background as like running commentary and kind of these footnotes and editorial commentary that frame what we're talking about. A new dictionary will come out hopefully in our lifetimes that will also help unite people, but you don't want to make the mistake of academia of inventing neologisms, right? Because that's super annoying. Because the words really we need to use probably already exist out there. Maybe being a classicist is better. Maybe just like, let's use the Greco-Roman dictionary and just go with that. You know, maybe that's the best one to do. We're going to call this a day. That is my phone. That would be a wife in the hospital with a newborn baby, my son Dario. So I'm going to take this call. Peace. I'm out. Hello?